Welcome to another episode of Conversation with the Experts. Whilst our setting is a tertiary paediatric hospital, our experiences and challenges are shared by many professionals and students in other clinical environments. I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations as the traditional owners and custodians of the land from which we provide our services. We pay our respects to the ancestors, elders, and emerging leaders of the Kulin Nations and extend our respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians accessing our resources. Welcome to the Conversation with the Experts podcast. I'm Imogen Boyle, a project officer working with the Education Hub at the Royal Children's Hospital and a trans woman, and my pronouns are she and her. Today I'm joined by Ken Knight, the Head of Research Impact and Consumer Involvement at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute. Ken is also chair of the Melbourne Children's Campus LGBTIQA+ Collective.
Hi, Imogen. It's great to be here.
Hi, Ken. And I understand that the collective has recently received funding from the RCH Foundation. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So this is some hot off the press, exciting news for the LGBTQIA+ communities across Melbourne Children's. And so just as a little bit of background, in 2022, the campus LGBTQIA+ collective was formed. And essentially, we are more than 150 dedicated LGBTQIA+ identifying staff, students, and allies, and really working together to cultivate an environment of safety and inclusivity for the community here on campus. Our essence, our work lies in our direct response to the specific known challenges faced by the community, and particularly by staff, but also by patients and research participants on campus. And so we know that LGBTQIA+ staff working in health and medical fields experience significant stigma and discrimination, that they often remain closeted and have poorer retention rates compared to their heterosexual peers. We also know that LGBTQIA+ children and young people are some of the most vulnerable in our society. And as a campus, we have lacked a concerted, coordinated effort to address those issues. There have been great pockets of innovation and activity in that space. We have a world-leading gender service and research program, but we haven't come together to unite and be greater than the sum of our parts. And so last year, we put together a Royal Children's Hospital Foundation grant to bring that strategy and action into life, and we were successful. And so over the next 3 years, we will be uniting to co-produce a strategy as a campus and align around policy development, education, events, advocacy, but importantly to center inclusive care and inclusive research as fundamental pillars of that strategy. So for folks who are listening who might not have heard of this before and might want to get involved, I would strongly encourage them to reach out to me and we will loop you in.
That's a wonderful initiative. Okay. So previously on this podcast, we've broken down the LGBTQIA+ acronym, but today I'd like to focus on the word queer. It's a word that can have various meanings, sometimes nouns, sometimes verbs. I'm wondering, could you talk about what the word queer means to you?
Absolutely. And it's a great question and it's a big question. And I have a few thoughts, so hopefully I will be coherent with them. And I guess, you know, firstly, I'd like to say that I identify as queer. I identify as a queer man and I use he, they pronouns. Reflecting on the notion of queer, I first came across that concept, I think, you know, 20 years or so ago in first year uni, doing gender studies. It really gave me then and still a language and a lens through which not only to view myself and my experience, which up until that point, you know, I think I was struggling to conceptualize fully, but the world and really make sense of things in my experience. And so I think the first thing that we need to think of is and understand is that it is a reclaimed term. So queer for many years was used as a derogatory slur for LGBTQIA+ folks. But we have brought it back, you know, into the fold, is largely now a celebratory term of community support and cohesion and building. But, you know, back to your point of, you know, is it a verb? Is it a noun? Is it both and how? I also think queer is also a really powerful lens through which we can look at the world and analyze the world and analyze ourselves. I'm not saying this is the kind of textbook example. This is just how I approach this term. One of the fundamental tenets is inclusivity. queer is an umbrella term that acknowledges, I think, the really rich diversity of the LGBTQIA plus communities and acknowledges that identity and desire and our experience and experiences are almost always fluid and intersectional, that we're not fixed and that is fine and that is great and that is our lived experience a lot of the time. And linked to that, I think, is this, as you know, kind of second pillar or notion of intersectionality, that we know that our identities, our sexual and gender identities, intersect with other aspects of our identity, such as, you know, our race, our class, our ability, nationality, so on and so forth. And so this approach really highlights the importance of understanding and addressing that multiple forms of experience are taking place simultaneously, but also multiple types of discrimination and marginalization take place simultaneously. And people endure that and people hold that as their experience. Queer is an opposition to and a critique of the notion of normal or heteronormative or normative, challenge to the idea that very fixed and binary categories of gender and sexuality are self-evident, and brings with it questioning of heterosexual and cis as the default, that that's where people start, that's our assumption, and you know, you are that unless you declare your, or you out yourself as otherwise. I also think that queer helps us critically examine things like power and social structures that marginalize people who aren't considered normal. I also think that queer invites us into community with that inclusivity. It invites us into activism and gives us a lens to social justice. You know, what might we do with queer here in our context in health and medical research? I think it's about living those values in our work. But for me, you know, the gift of queer is that the status quo is never inevitable. That change is the norm, and that, you know, that there's a joy, you know, and a beauty in that. But Imogen, you know, I'm rambling. I'm going to be a bit cheeky. What does queer mean to you?
Well, many things. First, I want to say what you were saying about not having a textbook answer. I think it's kind of against the nature of queer to have a textbook answer. It's something where, you know, everyone's perspective on it is equally as important. Mm. For me, queer is about recognizing that, you know, all these categories like straight, gay, cis, trans, they're constructs through which individuals have been categorized into types based on acts, which is not to say they're not real. The constructs have tremendous social power to structure our lives. But in recognizing that those things are constructed, it's possible to see how things might be different, particularly in other cultures than our own, that might hold different comprehensions of sex and gender. So the kind of view of sexuality that we have in the West is one view of sexuality, and the view of gender we have in the West is one view of gender. And so, you know, people in other cultures, they might have different views, and it's important to recognize those.
I love that as well, because not just in different cultures, but in the same culture at different points in time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I wonder, what opportunities can a queer perspective or a queer lens, as you say, bring to things like research and education?
The opportunities and the outcomes are transformational and profound. I think for me, and hopefully we can talk about this in some detail, really, I think it places the necessity for consultation and partnership and co-production with LGBTQIA plus community members at the heart of anything that we do. That is easy to say. I think it's much more complex and difficult to enable in practice. And one of the things that I'm very interested in thinking about, not only through the work of the LGBTQIA plus collective, but in my substantive role thinking about research impact and consumer involvement, is how do we co-create a well-supported system to enable that co-production and inclusion with community? And how do we place community in the center of decision-making that purports to benefit them in various ways, and really lean into that notion of nothing about us without us, decolonizing research and clinical practice, and ensuring that everybody, LGBTQIA plus folks, researchers, health workers, are provided with every possible opportunity to partner and to engage with clarity and purpose and with the rigor that this work mandates. And I think that will require and does require a very big investment and quite a large culture change. But I think we're there on the journey. We're kind of taking steps towards that. And I think having the campus very visibly and legitimately and in a well-resourced way support something like the LGBTQIA plus collective and our strategy development work really shows that there is buy-in and shows that there is a broad commitment to doing this well.
Right. So you mentioned co-creating knowledge with community. I think there's a certain image people have in their mind when they think about the word expert.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about expertise because the podcast is called Conversations with the Experts. What do you think expertise means when it comes to LGBTQIA plus communities?
It's a great question. And I have to say that I have a healthy ambivalence about the notion of the expert, and I'm always slightly amused when people introduce me as an expert in something and give them some gentle side eye. What do you mean? I think actually, though, we need to acknowledge that in health and in research, we are often moving in spaces where expertise is known and celebrated, but it's also experienced and enabled as a hierarchy. There are people who are experts in various things, in pediatric health, in research, and that's understood, and I agree, that is apparent. But I like to think about different kinds of expertise in the work that I do, or different kinds of knowledge in the work that I do, and acknowledge that we are all deep experts in our own lived experience and in the subjects and the tools and the processes that we are passionate about or that we do with regularity. But that to address any kind of change, any kind of transformation to enable an impact, we need to understand that we need to bring together different types of expertise. And so in health and research context, the notion of, again, nothing about us without us is extremely important. It's salient, and there is a rights-based imperative in our work to include LGBTQIA plus people in matters that, you know, there is a collective striving to benefit. That is our right as queer people. But in terms of achieving that change, I think we need to think broadly intersectionally. I think as well as bringing in that lived experience of LGBTQIA plus identity and desire and experience, we need to think about other kinds of knowledge and expertise. And so here I like to think about research knowledge. Researchers hold research knowledge, not only in terms of research methodology, but what the consensus of research is around a particular issue. Then we also have practice knowledge or practice wisdom, the folks at the coalface delivering care who see firsthand the burden of particular health conditions. They bring a particular knowledge and expertise to the table, which researchers and those with lived experience may not necessarily have. We also then have folks who are making policy or higher level decisions about issues. They bring a particular knowledge around the way those processes are enabled and activated. And then we have people at the health system level and at the organizational level who make decisions around funding, around prioritization. And while I would say that in any conversation around LGBTQIA plus expertise, we should be placing lived experience and community members at the center, by ourselves, we're probably not going to be able to achieve a meaningful, sustainable, transformational systems change. We're going to need to be involving all of those other holders of different kinds of knowledge and expertise along with us, and to co-create an intervention or even just co-create an understanding. Like, what does it mean? What is the burden of this issue? How is it understood, and how does it permeate the different spaces in which we work and that we live? So those are the things that I think about when I think about expertise, and hopefully bring a series of values around democratization and inclusion. We are dismantling that hierarchy that I mentioned, and that we are saying that all of these types of expertise, all of these types of knowledge are equal and necessary for us to kind of move.
Excellent. So what might that look like? So how can consulting with queer communities better inform the data we collect and the research we do.
And I think, look, I mentioned before that, you know, really embedding that process is, I think, the key challenge. I think we need to raise literacy. We need to build culture capability and capacity around what that means and what that looks like. And I think in a sense, we're being gently nudged by policy and practice, by the requirements of our health services. For example, for a hospital, for any health service to pass accreditation, it needs to demonstrate that it has consumers, so lived experience representatives at the heart of what we do and decision making. If any researcher working in health and medical research wants public funding for their work, they also now need to demonstrate that lived experience is a core part of their work. And so I think people are now aware that that is the reality, that we need to be doing this. I think the question becomes, how do we do this properly? Because if we don't do this well, we end up either being tokenistic, paying lip service to inclusion that isn't necessarily meaningful and isn't really ever community-led unless there is a deep and concerted push to make that part of the reality. But I think the promise of this is that our work will be significantly more relevant and the shared outcomes that we strive for will be more likely to be realized. I'm not saying that it's easy, but I'm also hoping that the co-produced approach that the LGBTQIA+ collective here on campus is starting will co-create answers to all those questions iteratively over time. And again, shameless plug, join us on that journey because we're going to be learning how to do this as we go.
Wonderful.
Having a focus on inclusion can only enrich our research and our data, its relevance, and the outcomes that we seek. And really, as I've been saying, this is part of an emerging sector-wide mandate and commitment to address inequities in health and medical research. And we know that there are multiple inequities in health and medical research. LGBTQIA+ inequities are one subset of that. But I'd also like to briefly outline some work that I was involved in last year, which brought together representatives of LGBTQIA+ communities, but also health and medical researchers who were doing research in the space of sex and gender. It brought us together in a series of what were called deliberative dialogues to develop recommendations to improve the use of sex and gender in health and medical research and decision making. And I'm just going to outline some of the decisions that that group kind of put forward as considerations for the sector to then lean into and invest in. And so fundamentally, at first, we said that we must advocate for the critical need for consideration of sex, sex characteristics, and sex and gender variables in health and medical research. Often, sex and gender is not asked about in health and medical research. It's considered subsidiary to the research question. It's considered irrelevant, or researchers find it too hard to approach meaningfully. And so fundamentally, we are saying that it should be asked, and it should be asked well, and that this is integral to quality and ethical research. That was the fundamental place that we landed. But we also acknowledged that the terms sex, sex characteristics, and sex and gender variables are again umbrella terms that inevitably cover multiple unique and interrelated concepts, and that those concepts and those terms will evolve inevitably over time and that they'll change. And so any kind of approach that we take needs to be iterative and deeply participatory. We need to be constantly engaging with researchers and with community to ensure that they're asking those questions in the right ways and that they are mindful of the way the community is identifying and terming itself. We also said that we need to monitor and benchmark use because there is a lack of consistency and a lack of clarity around how, when, why people are using this in research, people are asking these kind of questions in research. And fundamentally, as I've already said, we need to build the capacity of the sector. We can't say, okay, researchers, you got to do this now, and then not give them tools and support and education to do that well. And we also have to open up avenues for community when they encounter poor practice to be able to feedback that to the researchers themselves or to another body that can help build the capacity of the sector in response to identified areas of poor or even harmful practice.
That sounds tremendously important. like my perspective as a trans person, a number of times you get a question on a quiz that's like gender, male, female. These questions kind of make you wonder what they're collecting that information for and what information they're trying to get out of it. It just, they're not going to get very good data back if they're not informing the questions properly.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, Imogen. And I think we also, we've seen some examples where researchers ask a more open-ended question and then go and code the data in different ways. It's again, you know, really quite disingenuous. And I think there's a research integrity challenge there, but we know that that does happen and we need to do better.
So Ken, we've talked a lot about the importance of recognizing the diverse identities of LGBTQIA plus people through research. And that seems it could be a good antidote to shame, but pride is also a really important antidote to shame. Can you talk about pride and what it means?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Imogen. It's a great question. And I think particularly in the context of public commentary around, you know, kind of LGBTQIA plus activism and celebration, there is that wonderful quote from Hannah Gadsby who talks about, well, you know, what happens to the quiet gaze in the context of celebratory pride? And that is a conversation that we need to have. But for me, I think, you know, you really encapsulated it by saying that at its heart, LGBTQIA plus pride is fundamentally about resistance to shame. And let's be very clear, LGBTQIA plus shame is real and it's enduring. It's not a feeling that comes from within us as queer people. It's a feeling that is imposed upon us, I feel, very strongly by society through laws, through policies, and indeed through medical responses to us and through research responses to us if they're not done sensitively and in an affirming way. And those instances of shameful kind of feeling, making us feel shame, are both historical. We can point to historical instances where that has happened and that has been clear, but they're also ongoing. This happens on a daily basis. And I think that's a longer conversation that we need to be having as a campus and indeed as a community and indeed as a society. But I'd like to share a quote from Joe Ball about this because I think that he really beautifully encapsulated this in a piece of writing that I read of his recently. And so for those of you who don't know Joe Ball or don't know of his work, he's a trans man, an LGBTQIA plus activist and the CEO of Switchboard. He said, "Pride for me is striving for the profound inner feeling of acceptance and the ongoing resistance to institutional systems of shame. Pride for me is fostered within the collective doing of change making. For me, this is playing my role in the collective movement of shifting LGBTIQA plus lives from surviving to thriving."
That's a really beautiful quote.
What a call to action.
Very much. Now, I think it can feel like that shame comes from inside when the systems and the structures kind of impose it on us for so long that it's sort of, we almost feel like we're taught, I think, to feel that shame ourselves. Mm.
Absolutely.
It does seem like in some ways we are moving more towards research speaking to queer people and communities rather than just about us though, but it does seem like things can always be improved. How can we do better?
I think I've spoken about participatory approaches, centering community. I'm also really interested in thinking about how campuses like ours play a broader advocacy role. I think we're very comfortable thinking about inclusive care and inclusive research, or maybe increasingly comfortable thinking about those things. But I think we're only just beginning to move into a space where we feel comfortable about saying what good practice looks like for the sector broadly and for the community at large. And that is an interesting space. And I think it comes with a grave responsibility, but I think we need to have a clear-eyed view that the community, particularly the community of parents and families, look to the hospital, look to the campus as a trusted source of not only care, but of high-quality, rigorous and detailed and correct information. And so we have this really powerful mandate to, I think, encourage good and sensitive and appropriate perspectives, particularly when it pertains to LGBTQIA+ and trans and gender diverse children and young people specifically. And that is a space that we are beginning to move more confidently into. And so I've had the great fortune of being involved in some advocacy efforts here on campus. And so we've released a series of statements in support of trans and gender diverse children in response often to harmful public debate around their rights, you know, which in and of itself is it's deeply upsetting, I think, that actually is a norm, that people can talk very openly about the rights of trans and gender diverse young people. And we hold a lot of evidence that very clearly tells us that one of the key things that will get in the way of positive outcomes, that will cause harm to trans and gender diverse young people, is stigmatizing and marginalizing public debate. That is something which we know, and that's something which we're increasingly talking about. But I guess the question is a little bit broader as well. And I also was part of a group of staff who, during the marriage equality debate many years ago now, we wanted to say something publicly as a campus, and we thought carefully about what we might say, being the Melbourne Children's Campus. And we were particularly disturbed by a particular type of misinformation that was circulating with a lot of prominence, which was that children require a mother and a father, a man and a woman, to be well adjusted and to develop healthily. We were aware of the evidence, and the evidence said nothing about that. The evidence was clear that it was supportive, loving relationships that enable healthy child development. It has nothing to do with the gender or the sexuality of the caregivers. And so we wrote a paper for the Medical Journal of Australia, which was addressing the health and medical research sector specifically. And the paper was titled "The Kids Are Okay, It's Discrimination, Not Same-Sex Parents That Harm Children." Because what the research also told us was that the things that damage and harm the outcomes of not only trans and gender diverse children, but of same-sex parented families, is discrimination, is marginalization. You know, interestingly and kind of heartbreakingly in the context of that debate, the very fact that same-sex parented families couldn't marry was the kind of marginalization that will affect their outcomes negatively. And so we put that together as an evidence summary for the health and medical research community. And our call to action was, we must do better. We must challenge misinformation, and we must add our voices to what the evidence says will work for children and for families. And we've done something similar more recently. Another Medical Journal of Australia article, which is currently under review, which is titled "Trans Kids Are Just Kids." And essentially we say something similar, that, you know, trans children develop as other children do. What is leading to their vulnerability in society is the discrimination and the stigma that they are forced to endure by a heteronormative society that very actively discriminates upon them, and in leaders who are very comfortable in debating their presence and their rights within society. That's the stuff that is harmful. And so I think as a campus, we're becoming more comfortable adding our voices strategically in an informed and hopefully powerful way to those kind of conversations, and hopefully shifting the dial around the public's understanding, at very least the sector's understanding, of our duty of care as health professionals, as researchers, but also our responsibility to the evidence and to what we know will likely cause harm and what will mitigate harm.
That all sounds like fantastic work. I'm wondering, for people wanting to kind of inform their practice or their research, can you recommend any resources people can look to gain a better understanding in this area?
There are many resources, and maybe we can make some available.
We absolutely can.
Incredible.
Can.
There are too many, and I don't want to privilege just a few, but a couple of things on the campus I think are worth paying attention to. One is the SOGI guide. which is a really beautiful and accessible document which provides a broad introduction to language, to terminology, to processes in working inclusively with LGBTQIA plus folks. And that was brought together primarily to support the diversity in electronic medical EMR kind of process. And so that's something we can make available. Another really lovely initiative is called the Health Research for All Project, which is not LGBTQIA plus specific. It's broadly inclusive and intersectional, but it's essentially thinking about how we do inclusive research with all sorts of different groups that might otherwise go marginalized or missed. And so this was based upon some really nice work that we did a few years ago. We convened a range of focus groups of representatives of lived experience, but also of research in particular areas. LGBTQIA plus was one, culturally and linguistically diverse was one, accessibility or disability was one. And thinking about the kind of evidence-based tools that we should be, and validated tools that we should be using if we're asking questions around identity and around experiences that researchers we know, because they tell us, don't necessarily feel equipped to ask by themselves and are increasingly concerned that they might be inadvertently causing harm or contributing to stigma and discrimination if they ask those questions in the wrong way. And so that project is really about compiling a compendium, a menu of validated tools and ways of asking questions that kind of links really nicely into that broader program of work around addressing health inequities. And then the other one, which is, you know, I have to say, is a bit of a shameless plug again for my own program of work, but we are setting up a consumer and community involvement program across the Melbourne Children's Campus. And this is really saying, how can we place community and communities at the heart of everything that we do, not only at the hospital, not only at the Murdoch Children's Research Institute, but across the broad spectrum of the campus. And so we want and we need participation in that program. And we are very interested in everyone's perspective on how we do that well and how we do that inclusively so that we can genuinely co-create what that system looks like. And so no doubt we will have all sorts of tools and practical capability building initiatives arising out of that. But at this point, we're inviting people in just to kind of ideate with us around what better could look like and or what better might consider or might need to consider for us to shift the dial around inclusion and centering lived experience. So if that sounds of interest to you, please also reach out. And of course, the LGBTQIA plus collective will be co-producing and compiling LGBTQIA plus community specific resources around inclusive practice and just basic terminology for those who are uncertain and or want a bit of a guide in the space.
Great. While we're doing plugs, I thought it might be worth doing a plug for a group called Queers in Science, who are a group of people working in the sciences who are queer. And I understand you're one of the co-founders of Queers in Science. So we'll also add a link to their website in the description.
Absolutely. And so Queers in Science is a beautiful and transformational national initiative to build community and connection for LGBTQIA plus people working in science, technology, engineering, mathematics and methods. And it was developed from the Parkville precinct, and it's kind of amazing to have seen it grow into a national juggernaut.
Really wonderful organization. Can you tell me what better looks like to you?
Well, it's a big question. And I think, you know, in our conversation, Imogen, you know, we've covered a lot of that ground, but let me just kind of crystallize some of my thinking. So I think when we're thinking about better in terms of inclusive care and research, there are some core principles for me. I think the first one is embracing affirmation. And so in whatever we do, we must affirm the dignity and the inherent value of LGBTIQA plus people's sexual orientations, gender identities, and intersex status. This is a fundamental place that we must begin everything from. I think the other principle there is that we must ensure freedom from discrimination. And the third principle for me is leaning into access and equity. I think also when we think about better in the context of health and medical research and clinical care, we need to think about safety and LGBTIQA plus cultural safety specifically. So for those of you who are maybe unfamiliar with this term or kind of unclear about what it might mean, and it does mean different things and it needs to be co-produced, we'll talk about that. But it really requires us to have an understanding of the various histories, the safety needs, the power imbalances, and the influence of staff and organizational values and beliefs and practices on how we do research and deliver care and services. So I think, you know, fundamentally that makes cultural safety different from other approaches to improvement, because safety, you know, in and of itself must be defined by the LGBTIQA plus community in context. And that conversation needs to be inclusive. It will include multiple perspectives depending on intersectional lived experience. It's something that can't be owned and driven by the research institution or the healthcare provider. So I think for us, we need to very carefully, but in a forthright and frank way, ask, what are our histories of affirming inclusive care or otherwise? What have we learned? And what do we need to learn from? And who do we need to ask those questions? You know, and who do we need to hear responses when we ask those questions? And I think that there are some key reckonings that we need to have as a campus, as a community, and as a society in that space. And I think then that also requires us to have a deep and purposeful reckoning with that notion of co-production. So really thinking about how we work together in partnership with LGBTIQA plus communities so that we can understand and reflect upon the very real power imbalances involved often in research and in clinical care, and acknowledge that those power imbalances often perpetuate and cause harm to LGBTQIA plus folks. I also think as a collective, we have to work harder to build our capacity and our capability around safety, and acknowledge that's going to take some work. It's going to mean investing in ongoing education and training, in having curious and often hard conversations, and building and strengthening strategic partnerships across the entire campus, across different campus partners, across the sector, and indeed with different groups, advocacy groups, and community. You know, for those who might be new to this thinking around safety, a useful model that I've used more broadly in my work is provided by Amy Edmondson, who talks about psychological safety in teams. It's not specifically about cultural safety for LGBTQIA plus folks, but I think it's a good place to start to think about some core principles around safety in work and professional contexts. And she talks about co-creating environments where it's safe to identify, where it's safe to learn, where it's safe to contribute, and it's safe to challenge. Because I think one of our key challenges in this work is opening up conversations where everyone feels like they have a voice and can share their perspectives. And my reflection is often we don't do that very well at all. And that holds us back collectively from achieving better and understanding what better might look like. But Imogen, again, I'm really curious. You bring your own lived experience to this question on what might better and more inclusive look like for you.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks for asking. I think to get to better, it takes a changing of minds and a changing of hearts. And I think a big part of getting there will be for people to recognize that, you know, queer people and trans people and gay people, then we're not something that happens in a little silo where you can go, oh, that's the queers, and they have their own issues. Issues that affect queer people and trans people and all the members of the communities. These are issues that affect everyone. We all suffer from what we call cis-heteropatriarchy. Mm. These ideas, they're kind of damaging for everyone. They're particularly damaging for cisgender heterosexual men because they create a very narrow model of what's possible for gender expression. And that can be really harmful. And so I think when cisgender and heterosexual people start to realize that different expressions, different identities are available to them, they'll start realizing that change is something we can all share in and it will benefit everyone. That's my hope.
That was beautiful, Imogen. I think that's great.
So my last question, Ken, is do you have perhaps one takeaway about what members of LGBTQIA plus communities need from allies?
Oh, well, one takeaway is tricky, but I guess a thought would be for allies, and what true allyship looks like is to ensure that we have a space at the table, that decisions about us that affect us are not being made without us.
I think that's the fundamental. Look to us for guidance. Call out discrimination and exclusion wherever they see it, and do it loudly. And also join us. And I think that's the other thing about our campus collective is it's not only for community members. It's for everybody. I think another thing that communities, any kind of community-led change, can struggle with is the burden of having to do it all by ourselves. For us to genuinely shift the dial around inclusion and advocacy, we need our supporters and we need people who are working with us as allies. And so absolutely come and join us. This is an inclusive space and you know, we're radically accepting and hopefully radically respectful in our efforts to unite around transformational change for the LGBTQIA plus communities.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kent. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much, Imogen. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Conversation with the Experts, part of the Royal Children's Hospital Education Hub podcast series. If you'd like to hear more of our podcasts, check out our other podcast channel, Teach, Think, Treat, where we discuss aspects related to teaching and learning in a busy clinical setting.